All right, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you, please be seated. Good morning to everyone and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court hearing today in Portland, Idaho. Now, the court of court is Christy Ransom versus Potlatch, number one financial credit union. Appearing for the appellant, Eric Christy Ransom, is Ms. Susan Weeks. Good morning, ma'am. And Mr. Trey Turner is appearing with her. Ms. Weeks will argue. There are two respondents in this case. Potlatch number one is represented here by Samuel Creason. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And Michael Moser, individually, is represented here by Anthony Anagon. Good morning.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Counsel, do any of you have preliminary matters for the court to take up prior to your argument?
Not for the appellant, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. I'll look out. You will note, I guess, once you point out that Justice Yodi is not with us this morning. However, she will be fully participating in this matter, review the recording of this proceeding, and take place in this. The proceedings that take place this morning, she will participate fully in the proceedings with the court. So with that, Ms. Zuber.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Honorable Justices, respected counsel. We are here on appeal today regarding a district court's failure to rule on a motion to compel followed by a grant of summary judgment. We raise four issues on appeal, some of which involves procedure. So even though I don't normally discuss procedural issues with you when I'm discussing appeals, today I will. On August 27, 2019, Mr. Christensen filed a complaint against Michael Moser and Potlatch Credit Union following a decision by the Lewis and Roundup Association to discontinue contracting with him for the production of motorsports events. And I know my voice doesn't carry well anyway, but with the mask, if you're not hearing me, would you please let me know?
Yeah.
The complaint alleged that Moser, a Potlatch employee and also an LRA board member, had improperly accessed Christensen's Potlatch account information and shared it with the LRA so that it could recreate his business model and produce motorsports events without him and discover how best to capture the sponsors that he was using to sponsor the event. Potlatch answered that complaint on October 2nd, 2019. On December 10, 2019, Christensen filed a motion to compel discovery responses from Potlatch Credit Union with a hearing scheduled for December 26, 2019. As a courtesy to opposing counsel, the hearing was rescheduled to January. On December 16, 2019, both respondents, Mr. Moser and Potlatch Credit Union, filed for summary judgment for the same day as the motion to compel was scheduled. Christensen subsequently filed a motion to continue the summary judgment hearing and a motion for enlargement of time to respond to the summary judgment. The district court first took up the motion to continue. On the motion to continue, it stated, and I understand plaintiff's desire to engage in additional discovery, and I guess if I determine that there is additional discovery, that's appropriate. That would probably be a reason to deny summary judgment. So I'm going to go ahead and hear the motion for summary judgment. The motion to continue that hearing is denied. After hearing the summary judgment arguments, the district court took up the motion to compel and took it under advisement. The district court never ruled on the motion to compel discovery. The motion to compel addressed interrogatory number 13, which sought all policies and procedures regarding supervision of employees accessing a member's private banking information from the credit union, and interrogatory number 14 sought every known violation of the credit union's privacy policy by a former or current Potlatch credit union employee, supervisor, manager, or executive in the last 15 years.
Counsel, you stated a moment ago that the court never ruled on the motion to compel. In the court's decision on reconsideration, I believe it was in footnote 13, there is a reference to denying all pending motions, which I assume would have included the motion you're talking about. However, he did dismiss them on the grounds that they were moot. So in fairness, would it be more correct to say he didn't address the merits of the motion?
That would be more correct, Justice Miller. I raised four issues on appeal. I'm going to change the order of them from the brief, and the first one I'm going to address was issue 3 in our briefing, which does a credit union owe a fiduciary duty to its members based upon the membership agreement. The district court found that it did not, based on the Skinner case cited by both parties in their briefing and by the district court judge. The Skinner case held that there is no fiduciary duty created solely by the relationship between a bank and its customer. Rather, in that circumstance, the relationship is a lender and borrower, and it's a creditor and debtor relationship. This case also recognized, though, that a fiduciary duty could be established from agreements between the parties. Agreements between the parties was not argued in the Skinner case as a basis for establishing a fiduciary duty. After the Skinner case came the Bogon case, which said a fiduciary relationship exists when one party is under a duty to act for the benefit of the other upon a matter within the scope of the relationship. It's undisputed that the credit union had a membership agreement with Mr. Christensen, and the membership agreement said anything contained in that agreement or any other document supplied by the credit union was part of the agreement. Within the agreement, it specifically indicated that member accounts would only be used for purposes of the member's business and would not be disclosed to third parties. It also indicated, they also provided a privacy notice that pretty much reiterated the same thing but came as a separate notice. We submit that both of those documents, which were incorporated into the agreement, create a fiduciary relationship because it promises members that their information will be kept confidential and will not be disclosed to third parties and will only be used by the credit union and its affiliates to transact the business of the member. So we would submit, Justices, that there is a legal duty, a legal fiduciary duty, under the facts of this case when you have a credit union membership agreement assuring a member that they will have rights to privacy and their information will not be shared.
So, counsel, isn't that promise a typical contractual promise? Contracts always involve promises, right? I'll do this, you do this. Are you asking us to say every promise made in a contract gives rise to a fiduciary duty?
No, but I am saying when it's a contract term that addresses the privacy rights of an individual, it does come to a fiduciary duty because unlike one that says I will pay you on October 8th, that's not a fiduciary duty if I don't pay you on October 8th. I've made no promise that affects your privacy interests or your rights within the contract to prevent other people from obtaining information that I wouldn't have given you but for the agreement.
Well, is it your position that this is a special relationship akin to an insurance agent client?
There are some cases, Justice Stegner, that we could have analyzed it to, but I didn't think they were quite as good as the Bodine case. But yes, it could be analyzed to an escrow. For an escrow holder, it could be analyzed to an insurance agent. It could be analyzed to some of those other special relationships that Idaho has recognized.
So one of the questions I have, Ms. Weeks, is to kind of explain Moser's involvement in this matter. It seems to me that he had a conflict of interest in dealing with Mr. Christensen, because he was also on the Lewis and Roundup Association's board. Is that a fair way to characterize what was going on in Mr. Moser's business relationship with Mr. Christensen?
When he started disclosing information he should not have been disclosing, then he had a conflict of interest. I think if he had kept that information to himself, the conflict wouldn't have been one that prevented him from serving on the board.
So, counsel, where is there evidence that Mr. Mosier actually shared this information outside of himself or Potlatch?
So it's circumstantial evidence. We have the phone call from not only a board member, but a second member of the credit union who calls, and his name is David Lonely, who calls Mr. Christensen and tells him they discussed his information. They call soon after they terminate or tell Mr. Christensen that they are not going to renew his contracts for the next year. Then he requests almost immediately information from the credit union.
I'm sorry, before you move on to the next point, Mr. Langley never actually said Mr. Mosier accessed Mr. Christensen's information, did he?
That's a disputed issue of material fact. Mr. Christensen said he did tell him that.
Okay, where is that in the record?
Well, he didn't say he accessed it. He said he shared it, and that is in the record, and I don't have that available off the tip of my tongue, but it is in my briefing.
Because when I read the deposition testimony, which was the only place I could see any reference to testimony under oath about this phone call, it doesn't appear that Mr. Christensen said Lumley told me Mosier accessed it.
No, he doesn't say accessed. He said shared it.
And I don't see anywhere in that deposition where Mr. Christensen says Lumley told me Mosier shared it with the Roundup Association.
And I don't have that in front of me, but I do believe, and I have cited it in the record, that that is what Mr. Christensen has testified to. Now, whether it's through declaration or in his deposition, I do not recall, Justice Zahn.
Okay.
So help us, since this is summary judgment, we're dealing with reasonable inferences then. So let's get from point A to point Z. How do we draw the reasonable inference you want us to draw here?
Sure. So we have Mr. Christensen saying that he was informed by another board member who also works as a manager at Potlatch Credit Union that Mr. Mosier has shared his information with the board. We then have the client asking for whatever report they have that can show who has accessed his accounts. After about 4 months, although Potlatch ran that inquiry right away and it showed Mr. Mosier had accessed the accounts, after about 4 months, they finally gave that to Mr. Christensen, and it shows that Mr. Mosier was accessing his accounts. Mr. Mosier is a mortgage banker. Mr. Christensen has no mortgage with Potlatch Credit Union. There was no purpose for Mr. Mosier to be looking at Mr. Christensen's account. And Mr. Moser's only testimony on why he did it is, I can't remember why I did it. Then you have Mr. Lumley, who they give a declaration, and Mr. Lumley says, never talked to the man in my life, but we have 85 emails between him and Mr. Christensen that we put into the record. So now you have a credibility issue with Mr. Lumley. He's on the one hand saying he's never texted, telephoned, or talked to Mr. Christensen, and we have a trail of 85 emails showing that there's a credibility issue with Mr. Lumley. So we have circumstantial evidence that takes us to that point that, but for this call, Mr. Christensen would have had no knowledge that his account had been accessed by Mr. Mosier. And the report verifies that it was. And I know that's circumstantial evidence, but I would remind the court that Scott Peterson was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt under circumstantial evidence in California of murdering his wife. Similarly, just because you vehemently deny something, even in a declaration, doesn't mean it's true. I just got done reading a World War II biography, and Hitler and the SS denied there were death camps or that they were engaged in genocide. We all know at the end of World War II they were not telling the truth. So just because somebody vehemently denies something and puts it in a declaration and says it didn't happen The jury is entitled to look at the circumstantial evidence and decide who they believe is telling the truth.
I don't think it's an issue of whether circumstantial evidence is admissible or not. We have a jury instruction that specifically says that. I think it's an issue of whether the inferences are reasonable. In this case, certainly, you've outlined, if we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to your client, that some things happened that really raised some eyebrows. Can we draw, though, the inference that it was nefarious?
I'm sorry, can you draw the inferences?
That it was with nefarious intent.
I think you can. Because we give you the board's minutes right before Mr. Christensen is told that they are not going to contract with him again. And in that, you see a strange array of a series of motions that you normally don't see when you're dealing with a board meeting. So first there is a motion and a second to approve his upcoming contract. Then, immediately after that, there is a motion to table the matter to allow the board to gather more information. Then, there is a motion to not contract with Mr. Christensen, which passes. These motions keep passing. And in the discussion following that from the minutes, and that's the September minutes of 2019, you see that the board discusses their concerns about Mr. Christensen and they discuss sponsors. So what happened from the board walking into the boardroom to the board walking out of the boardroom? Then they also informed Mr. Christensen that the reason they didn't engage in contract negotiations with him was because it wasn't profitable to them. The LRA board was collecting from Mr. Christensen's events the greater of 20% of tickets or $4,000 per event day. They weren't expending any money on it. An inference can be drawn that it was profitable for them. So what happened in that board meeting that made them decide that they would be better off sponsoring the event themselves? And what happened, I would submit, is the inference is that Mr. Moser shared how much money Mr. Christensen was making on his sponsorships, because they knew what he was making on the tickets. And the board decided they would like a bigger bite of the profit and decided now that they had the information on what they could get on sponsorship, they would start taking over the demolition derby, and Mr. Christensen was out.
You've laid out for us what you have in the record. What is it was sought under the 56B motion by way of additional discovery, and was that made known to the district court in specificity relative to why it should exercise its discretion in favor of Mr. Christensen?
So, again, Chief Justice, it was interrogatory number 13 for the policies, procedures regarding supervision of employees accessing a member's private banking information, and also the interrogatory number 14, seeking to know every violation of the credit union's privacy policy by a former or current Potlatch credit union employee and its officers and agents.
And did the court ever rule on the objection that was vague or overbroad?
No. As Justice Mueller pointed out, the only thing that the court ever said was it was moot because it granted summary judgment and denied the reconsideration.
Since we're on the procedural topic right now, I wanted to circle back to that for just a moment. Now, I realize these masks make it hard sometimes to judge our affect, and you might have taken my earlier questions as hostile, and I actually had the exact opposite intent. This question, though,
well, if you perceive me as being hostile, I did not.
No. I perceive you as being overly defensive, but not hostile. This question, though, is meant to be a little more critical. The strategic decision that was made by trial counsel to not respond to summary judgment other than by filing the request for Rule 56D could be viewed by some as hubris, just kind of banking on the fact that the court was going to grant the extension of time without filing anything in response to the merits of the motion for summary judgment. Now, I understand the catch-22 you're in responding to those, but wasn't it hubris not to even attempt to respond to summary judgment by filing something in response to the legal issues based upon the record that they did have.
And I understand your question, Justice. I wasn't the underlying trial counsel, but I will note this. He was scheduled for vacation. I think he was trying to work with opposing counsel. He had just extended the courtesy to them of moving his motion so they could enjoy their holiday vacation at Christmas. Then he got the summary judgment as he was leaving for a holiday vacation. I don't think it was hubris. I will admit it was a young attorney mistake, and I bet that it doesn't happen again.
Well, and counsel, let me ask you, in the motion to continue, I didn't see Rule 56. I didn't see any rule.
It was
cited.
Not in there. A rule was not cited, but to say that you must cite the rule, I think, would exalt form over substance. It was a motion to continue and for an enlargement of time, both of which is addressed by Rule 56.
And then in regard to the materials that trial counsel then submitted in support of the motion for reconsideration, it appeared that most, if not all, of those were publicly available pieces or information that was available to Mr. Christensen. So does that qualify as new evidence for purposes of the motion?
I disagree with you that everything was available. When Mr. Christensen's counsel was unable to get even just the member agreement, he found that online after searching for it. But we still don't have any internal policies. We don't have any of their internal procedures.
Right, and I'm referring to the materials that were actually submitted in support of Mr. Christensen's motion for reconsideration. I guess my question is there any reason trial counsel couldn't have obtained those before the summary judgment and submitted them in opposition to summary judgment? Because the basis for the reconsideration was, I have new evidence, and I want you to look at that. Was any of that actually new, or it just wasn't gathered until after summary judgment?
I don't know the answer to that, Justice Song. I do know that it was new to the district court, and I don't think that Mr. Christensen was dilatory, his counsel was dilatory in trying to obtain the discovery. He was trying very hard, as you see from the letters, to get his discovery in order. He was being told he didn't need to take depositions because the other side deemed them irrelevant. He got many objections to his discovery and wasn't getting his discovery. Counsel on the other side characterizes that as sandbagging. I think there was some of that going on. And in the light of that and the district judge not ruling on the motion to compel and not saying, yes, you can get this, then Mr. Christensen's counsel was in the posture of needing to try and gather at least enough without the motion to compel to show the district court there were questions of fact.
Okay. And I know your light is red, but I just have two more questions. One is, it looked like there was only one claim pled against Mr. Moser, the invasion of privacy claim, and that doesn't appear to be an issue on this appeal, but am I missing something about why is Mr. Moser still involved in this
appeal? Sure. As we put in our reply brief, because the tortious interference with contract is the employee's tort, and it's Mr. Moser. And if there's not respondeat superior for the credit union to be responsible for that, Mr. Moser is still responsible for his own tort because it's the tort of an employee that is on respondeat superior, but it's the tort is the tortious interference. So through respondeat superior, it goes to potlatch, but if there's not respondeat superior, and it's determined by a jury that Mr. Moser did do that, he still tortiously interfered.
And so it's your assertion that the tortious interference with contract claim was actually pled against Mr. Moser as well as potlatch?
It's pled against both, yes.
Okay. And then you kind of dovetailed nicely into my next question, which is, all right, if Mr. Moser does all of this, why? I understand the negligent supervision. I understand respondeat superior, but why do you believe, or where's the evidence in the record, I guess, that Mr. Moser was acting on behalf of Potlatch when he did these things?
Well, Potlatch has, as you can see, several board members on the board, and again, we didn't have the opportunity to take depositions, but I'm sure that the employer encourages community activities. That's not in the record. But when he's providing that information as an agent of Potlatch, I would say he's acting on behalf of the credit union. Now, a jury might disagree and say, no, respondeat superior, because we think when he did that, he was Don Rambo. There's also some indication in the record that Mr. Moser, Potlatch knew Mr. Moser was doing this because another manager was sitting there listening to him do it. And there's another lawsuit, which, because of the truncation of discovery, where Mr. Moser has been accused of this in the past, and that was one of the things that was sought in interrogatory number 14.
Well, actually, that lawsuit accused Mr. Moser or another employee, right?
That is true.
Okay.
But that's part of what was sought in interrogatory 14 that was never provided. So trial court says that lawsuit has very little relevance because we don't know what happened. Well, we're unable to tell the trial court what happened because we didn't get the answers to the discovery.
Okay.
So we're in a catch-22. And I am over my time. I would like to reserve the rest for my rebuttal.
Thank you. It's my understanding, Mr. Creason, you are the first for 20 minutes, and Mr. Anagon will take the final 10. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
Very well. You may proceed, and I assume our esteemed clerk will take care of the timing for each of you gentlemen. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court, counsel. May it please the court. Mr. Christensen has tried to distract from the fundamental basis of his case throughout litigation, although I will say that appellate counsel is much more straightforward about the fundamental basis than what was occurring in the underlying case. The trial court began the summary judgment hearing with an exchange with plaintiff's counsel that can be found on pages 11 through 13 of the transcript on appeal. It begins with the following exchange. The court, well, okay, Mr. Turner, what I'm about to hear is that the issue is not whether Potlatch Federal Credit Union employees like Mr. Moser accessed Potlatch Credit Union's information regarding Mr. Christensen, but whether it was disclosed. Isn't that the issue? Mr. Turner, I'm sorry, will you repeat that? The court, isn't the issue more not whether they accessed their own information regarding Mr. Christensen, but whether it was disclosed without authorization to third parties? Isn't that the basis of the action here? Mr. Turner, so that is the basis of the action. However, the premise is, in this case, that the plaintiff is allowed to complete discovery before having to respond to summary judgment. So here's the trial court clarifying with plaintiff's counsel, what's the basis? And plaintiff's counsel confirms that the whole basis of the case is disclosure outside of P1FCU, and plaintiff's counsel confirms that at a time when he knows that we've submitted 31 sworn declarations from everyone who was on the board from 2014 to 2018 saying, we never heard anything about Mr. Christensen's financial information.
But counsel, when you submit those 30 declarations, don't you put all 30 of those people at issue, and now Mr. Christensen has the right to depose them before a summary judgment?
I apologize, Justice Sum. He absolutely does, and he never tried.
Well, he had some depositions set at the end of December that I understand from the record you asked him to move because you wanted to take some time with your family at Christmas, and nobody faults you for that. But he never got to take those depositions, and they had been scheduled for the end of December, isn't that right?
That's correct, but those were not the depositions of any LRA members. Those were the depositions of the CEO of P1FCU and the Executive Vice President of P1FCU, which plaintiff concedes that were not members of the LRA. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that he issued notices duces tecum to them and didn't set it out the proper number of days. And the third problem is that we have had a discussion, which is in the record on December 4th or 6th, saying where we candidly said, look, I'm going to object with you taking the top brass's depositions on the basis that everyone who could be a direct witness has already said it didn't happen, and you're not even challenging that. So we don't get to any of the other torts.
we all understood, or understand, the court certainly understood, that that could be the basis of a Rule 56D defense, that a motion to compel was forthcoming, we knew, and the court could rule, no, P1FCU, you're going to have to sit for these depositions because the court finds that there is a tribal issue, a genuine issue, material fact on whether it was shared. And that's why the court began its soliloquy or its dialogue with plaintiff's counsel at summary judgment is, what are we really talking about here? And even on appeal, in his reply brief, Mr. Christensen writes, quote, Christensen agrees P1FCU obtained declarations from the entire Williston Roundup Association board members denying anyone spoke to them about Christensen's P1FCU accounts and testifying none recalled any board member, including Moser, reviewing or discussing financial information about Christensen or his business enterprises.
Since when do we hold counsel to the standard that if they've received opposing affidavits, that's all that's necessary for discovery? It seems to me there's just some troubling things in this case about the timing. On December 6th, you sent out the Rule 37 letter, and then 10 days later, you filed a motion for summary judgment. And, of course, that's scheduled right after Christmas, conveniently on the same day that the motions to compel that were in part, at least, touched on by the December 6th letter. It just seemed like you were creating an impossible situation, at best a catch-22, as I said earlier, but in reality, almost an impossible situation for plaintiff's trial counsel unless the Rule 56D motion was granted.
And Justice Mueller, I do want to address that head-on, because I take very seriously the allegation of sandbagging. We won this case on the
merits. I'm not necessarily suggesting sandbagging, but it seems like very tactical timing to greatly disadvantage the plaintiff in this case.
Well, within 10 days after the complaint was filed, we did what plaintiffs should have done. We talked to all the LRA members. They said, that didn't happen. And so plaintiffs kept pushing on everything but the fact that there was no disclosure. And so the response of defendant is, why do you get to take depositions that are all about supervision policies and unrelated alleged disclosures, when the underlying premise of your case never happened, and you're not even challenging that? And that was, so that there was a good faith basis to say, we're not going to make the CEO sit here, when the fact is the underlying factual premise of your case has been attested to as untrue, and you're not even trying to take depositions to find out whether someone lied. But to go back to that exchange between trial counsel and the court, the premise was by plaintiff's counsel at the summary judgment hearing that so long as he presented the court with nothing more than a bare motion to compel and motion for continuance, which he did, that was enough to stop him from having to respond to any sort of summary judgment hearing. Rule 56D is clear. It gives clear guidance to the district courts. And notwithstanding the fact that the rule expressly requires an affidavit or sworn declaration, the court still tried to lead plaintiff's counsel through a Rule 56D proffer. In the transcript on appeal in pages 11 and 12, we read, quote, the court, what do you want to do? Mr. Turner, I would like to have that hearing continued until we complete discovery. The court, what discovery do you want to do? Mr. Turner, I want depositions, I want privacy policies, I want emails. There's no specificity there, and the point of it is, I understand the justice's questions, if they were pushing at, is there a genuine issue of material fact on the disclosure? But that's not what they were seeking below, and it's certainly not, by their express briefing, what they're seeking above.
When we review the trial judge's decision to deny the 56D motion, it's decided on an abuse of discretion standard, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The fourth plank of the Lundberg test for abuse of discretion is the decision has to be reached through the exercise of reason. Here's the reason that was given by the trial judge, and this is paraphrased. The trial judge said that he's going to deny the Rule 56D motion for an extension because it could deny the summary judgment if it determined additional discovery was needed. Help me to understand why that's the exercise of reason. That sounds like, at best, circular reasoning. It seems like a non sequitur. Certainly, it's begging the question, by saying, I'll decide if discovery is needed after we argue the case and I see if discovery is needed. Shouldn't the plaintiff have an opportunity to bring their best case forward on summary judgment without having the judge make a preliminary decision, nah, it's not going to make a difference even though I haven't heard it yet?
So the focus of the Supreme Court should be on what discovery is requested. What discovery does the plaintiff say is needed? So Judge Broody was presented with the declaration of every single board member saying that didn't happen.
But Mr. Christensen contradicted one of those board members. And that strikes me as a genuine issue of material fact when there's a conflict between what one witness says and what another witness says.
Well, Your Honor, if we could go to Mr. Christensen's evidence for a moment and look at what he was actually contradicting. Mr. Christensen was not at the meetings. He has a one-page document found in the record at page 275, which speaks for itself, an automated populated document that speaks for itself. And in light of that, Mr. Mosier's testimony, his deposition wasn't taken, so his sworn declaration saying, I don't recall exactly why I viewed it. He gave some reasons why he could have, but he certainly didn't share it. So there's that piece of evidence.
And isn't that an inference that Mr. Mosier doesn't remember, and so that's an inference that would benefit Mr. Christensen?
That he doesn't remember?
We can draw an inference from that, that it could be nefarious.
I don't see that as a reasonable inference without more evidence. The only fact is that he doesn't remember.
So he's the mortgage broker for Outrush Number 1 Federal Credit Union. He has no reason to access Mr. Christensen's information. He's done so 8 times previously and says, oh, I don't remember why I did that. I think you can draw a nefarious inference from that.
Perhaps with more, Your Honor, but again...
You don't need more. You've got a conflict in the testimony. Why do you need more?
Because you're assuming that what the document says is that he somehow accessed some particular accounts. That document speaks for itself. And I'll let Mr. Anagon talk a little bit about Mr. Mosier's declaration, but his recollection was probably to get his name and address to send him a check. I mean, we don't know with the automated population.
8 times?
This is over the course of years, and they would meet throughout the year.
Well, and counsel, the credit union isn't asserting that what Mr. Mosier did was okay, is it?
It's asserting that we don't even know what Mr. Mosier did, and he certainly didn't share it, and it's our information.
Right, but if he can't remember why he accessed the account information, and there's no evidence in the record to suggest he had a legitimate purpose to access the account information, you're not asserting that was okay, are you?
If what came out was that he went through the details of the account information without any legitimate purpose, then Mr. Christensen, I think, may have an invasion of privacy tort if that was never disclosed. But Mr. Christensen stipulated away his invasion of privacy tort. And so I could say, under facts that were different than these, would the credit union say that was okay? No. But Mr. Christensen hasn't pursued the invasion of privacy tort because he didn't want to pursue damages. The other issue, Justice Zahn, is that you asked plaintiff's counsel, where is it in the record what Mr. Lumley said? Because that is the plaintiff's burden, particularly as the appellant. The only place I could find, Your Honor, is on pages 805 through 806 of the record. What it says is that Mr. Christensen was called by somebody who identified himself as Mr. Lumley, that they said, well, there's been people accessing your bank account. They are looking to push you out to do their own events. What they don't know is what you were taking in for sponsor money, what your expenses were. They were trying to recreate your business model. That's it. That's all that's alleged. No Mr. Mosier, no LRA. That's all I could find in this record. That's the comment. And in light of that, I think that the court has to take that statement as true for purposes of summary judgment. But the court, when drawing reasonable inferences, does not have to blind itself to the fact that other facts are undisputed, like Mr. Christensen couldn't recall when it happened in the 33-day period. He couldn't recall what the day of the week was, what the time of the day was. He would tell me that it lasted longer than 30 seconds, but he couldn't recall between that and 20 minutes how long it lasted.
Well, counsel, how is that inability to recall really that different than Mr. Moser's inability to recall why he accessed the account 8 times?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that when you're looking at reasonable inferences, the court should consider both. I think the court has to consider both and say, okay,
When do we have reasonable inferences that we draw against the non-moving party?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When do we have reasonable inferences that we draw against the non-moving party?
This is
a radical proposition.
I wasn't intending to say draw reasonable inferences against the non-moving party, but what I was intending to say is that the court has a burden of, or has set a precedent of saying that the non-moving party has to come forward with material, genuine, non-speculative evidence such that reasonable inferences can be drawn in their favor. You can't get up and just say, well, I got an anonymous call that's uncorroborated.
I identified Lumley as the caller in his deposition.
He says that. Lumley, the court had a declaration saying that didn't happen.
I understand all of that.
Right. And so that was his evidence, was the one-page document, his testimony on Lumley. And in light of that evidence, the court had every single direct witness saying it simply didn't happen.
Strikes me that's a weight question that goes to the jury.
Well, and I would disagree. I would say, Your Honor, that Rule 56 says, in express, it says that there must be material and genuine, and this court in its case law said mere conclusory allegations or slight doubts don't get you there. But the other basis for denial of the defendant's motion not only is substantive, but procedural. The plaintiff's Rule 56D defense is not only substantive, but procedural. Plaintiff, after agreeing that we would set the summary judgment hearing in early January, plaintiff then decided not to respond until the day before. And even the board of directors' minutes, which plaintiff's counsel relies upon, on a appellate argument, was provided by plaintiff the day before the hearing and was unauthenticated. But because of the court's desire to allow plaintiff to argue, we let them argue it because it simply didn't happen. I would like to turn to the issue of the fiduciary duty issue.
Well, just so you made the comment, you let them argue. Help me understand what that meant.
Yeah. We did not file a motion to strike those materials. And so I think that the court, on Rule 56, the modern wording, the court can on its own disregard them as not admissible as required by the rule. But I would say that there isn't a motion to strike in the record.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
On the fiduciary duty issue, the plaintiff asked this court what it describes as a novel issue, an issue of first impression. And it asked this court to find that in light of the settled law of financial institutions, the inapplicability of this authority cited both before the district court and on its opening brief. It wasn't until the reply brief. And the lack of connection in these facts between the credit union function and the alleged violation. And then finally, the lack of evidence supporting the dissemination. This court in the past has looked for relationships of trust and intimacy to identify fiduciary duties. And as the court in Washington, as the District Court of Columbia, and as Alabama, who have addressed this, have both looked at, the practical reality is credit unions are not small. They are akin to banks. And we have never found banks to have that fiduciary duty just by nature of the relationship. Skinner, Bordone, First Federal Savings and Loan but Skinner and Bordone have discussed the idea of, well, if you have complete control and it's insurance proceeds, maybe you get there, but not on these facts. Here, they're trying to extend Bordone's one sentence about the fact that any relationship that gives rise to fiduciary duty to define a fiduciary duty in every relationship. And I think Justice Zahn, you're right. It would eviscerate fiduciary duty law to find it under these facts. This is not the case to find a new cause of action in the state of Idaho. But even if the court were inclined to say perhaps there is a fiduciary duty from credit unions to its members, there's no causal connection between that fiduciary duty and the damages that are alleged in this case, because there was no dissemination and the invasion of privacy tort was stipulated away by plaintiff.
Doesn't the fact that this is a credit union, and you use the phrase like credit unions use, refer to the depositors as members, somewhat change the analysis? I don't think the bank or ID My Banking calls me a member.
Yeah. I do think that there is a distinction between banks, but it's a statutory distinction, and it's a practical distinction. Perhaps a different credit union that was a cooperative that had very few members, perhaps the court would say, in those unique circumstances, we're going to find a fiduciary duty. But when the court's found fiduciary duties, it does look for private ordering, for relationships that arise as a matter of common law and contract between the members. Whereas credit unions, particularly P1FCU are large institutions that are monitored by regulation, and their relationship to the members is administered by regulation, not by each other. Members of the court, I'd like to leave you with this. When you look at what discovery was cut off, you have to look at what discovery was requested, even on appeal. Supervisory policies and unrelated violations of some privacy policy, which we're still not sure what he's talking about there. That's what they're saying they should have been given the right to conduct discovery into, not into whether the dissemination occurred at all. And before you and before the district court was the direct testimony, uncontradicted and unequivocal, that there was no dissemination. Thank you, Justice.
I don't think it's accurate to say that it's uncontradicted. I think Mr. Christensen's testimony is that it's contradicted.
Mr. Christensen wasn't present at the meeting.
Yes, but the evidence is that Mr. Lumley called Mr. Christensen and told him things that are contrary to his sworn declaration.
Well, the evidence in
that's
the record...
That's what I call contradiction.
The evidence in the record at page 805 and 806 will speak for itself, Justice Stegman, and our position is Judge Brewer got it right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, may it please the court. I represent Michael Moser, who was individually named in this lawsuit, even though, as you can read from the briefing and everything, you see it's almost entirely directed at P1FCU. And I agree with what Mr. Creason stated in his argument, but my focus today is another reason why the summary judgment in favor of Mr. Moser should be affirmed. But before I get to that, I want to address a couple things that came up in arguments. First of all, as far as, this is the inquiry tracking report, it's in the record. I mean, it doesn't tell you anything. It's a computer-generated document. And Justice Stegman, you're correct, there's 8 entries that have Mr. Moser's initials. He doesn't deny that, but it's over 5 dates, over 2.5 years. It's undisputed, based on what Mr. Christensen testified in his deposition, that during the time that Mr. Moser was the special events coordinator, he was in Mr. Moser's office 50 times. 50 times. That's more than once a month. And Mr. Moser's declaration doesn't say, I don't know. I have no idea what I looked at. There is a statement like that. I can't even recall exactly what I looked at, but he does say, it's very likely on those dates, I was pulling up information for his contact information on how to make out a check. So it's not like he just said, well, I just looked at this and I don't know what I looked at. But there's no evidence in this record that he disclosed any information to anyone. He also never was one of the, because he was president of the board, he did not vote at this meeting. As board president, he did not vote at the September 26th meeting where they decided not to renew contracts. And it's also undisputed in this record that he was actually the only member of the board that was actually supportive of Mr. Christensen.
Is there any fact that he was president of the board strengthen your position any. I get that he didn't get to vote, but being president of the board, doesn't that give him quite a bit of ability to affect the outcome of the proceedings?
Well, I represent boards. Every board operates different. All I can tell you is that he didn't vote on that, and it's also undisputed in the record that was supportive of Mr. Christensen. And Mr. Christensen had the opportunity to dispute that in his deposition. He filed multiple declarations in this matter. He never said, Mr. Mosier said this or did that, or he was against me, Mosier wanted to get me. Didn't say anything like that. So our position is that's undisputed. The second point I want to make is I just want to indicate that Mr. Creason's absolutely correct. There's nothing in this record where Mr. Lumley said Mr. Mosier was the one providing, specifically the person providing the information. They've asserted that in their brief over and over and over. It simply is not correct. There's nothing in this record that states that. Against this backdrop, what I want to talk about is why Mr. Mosier should no longer be a party in this action, no matter what the court's decision is. The complaint in this matter alleged 9 separate causes of action. And most of them have been dismissed, or at least the majority have been dismissed, and only 5 of the 4 of the subject was appealed. Of the 9 causes of action, when I filed a brief in support of the motion for summary judgment, and an oral argument at the January 16th hearing, I pointed out to the district court that only 1 count in the complaint was directed against Mr. Mosier, and that was invasion of privacy, which was dismissed and is not an issue on this appeal. There's never been any, until the reply brief on appeal was filed, there was never any disagreement. In fact, I didn't point this out in my brief, but the district court, in its first order and opinion on the motion for summary judgment, said that page 596 in the record, footnote 8, while Christensen asserts all claims against P1FCU, he asserts only a claim of tortious breach of privacy against Mosier individually. Then they filed a motion, what they call a cross motion for reconsideration. They never contested that. In fact, they talked about the interference with contract morphed into interference with a prospective economic advantage, yet in their brief, and they filed hundreds of pages of documents literally in support of their motion for reconsideration, but in their brief at page 722 and 723 in the record, they do not say, oh, by the way, we really were asserting this claim against Mr. Mosier individually. What they talk about mostly, what the counsel talks about mostly in their brief, is respondeat superior. And I know from pleading cases for almost 4 decades, you can name somebody in the complaint and say, well, they did this, and by virtue of the reason of respondeat superior, the company is liable. You don't name them individually. Do it all the time. And that's what they did here. That's what the whole complaint was set up, except for 1 count, and that's invasion of privacy. And that was dismissed. And now, in the reply brief, for the first time, oh, by the way, we're asserting this new cause of action against Mr. Mosier for interference with prospective economic advantage.
I want to be clear. Are you faulting plaintiffs for including your client in the original complaint? I mean, how did they know that your client wasn't going to raise a defense in which all of you pointed your fingers at him, but your client?
Well, I'm not faulting them. I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm just saying the way they pled it, there was only 1 count directed at him. Even in the complaint, I mean, the complaint makes it crystal clear. On interference with contract, they say in paragraph 5.5 at page 19, as a direct and proximate result of P1FCU's intentional interference with plaintiff's contract, as said in another paragraph in the complaint, too, 3.29. I'm not faulting them, but as the record stands now, all the causes of action are directed at P1FCU, not Mr. Mosier. The district court recognizes. We pointed it out to them.
Isn't this, though, in your 4 decades of litigation experience, isn't this the very essence of the civil adversarial process? Where, based on reasonable cause, they file a petition, they make a complaint, they make allegations, and then they engage in discovery to flesh out what evidence support those, and maybe even finding more evidence that they weren't expecting to find, perhaps hoping to find, but not expecting to find. I mean, it seems to me this is how the adversarial process is supposed to work in Idaho.
Well, I'm not sure what discovery is part of the adversarial process.
When I say adversarial process in Idaho, I'm referring to discovery as well.
Right.
Isn't this how we provide a fair trial to everybody? By letting them bring their allegations, there has to be some reasonable basis for the allegations, and then they get to look at the evidence and decide where to go from there.
Well, except that in this instance, we had a summary judgment. The judge ruled on the one count that was against Mr. Moser, that invasion of privacy, said that's dismissed, that's not an issue on appeal. Everything else in the pleadings. And you go to the pleadings count at some point. I mean, there's a case, Smith versus Glen Ferry Highway District, 166 Idaho 683, which basically says a defendant's response to facts or theories can signal acknowledgement of claim. We acknowledged that the only claim against Mr. Moser was one claim, invasion of privacy. They didn't contest that until their reply brief.
But don't parties amend complaints all the time prior to discovery being completed? I mean, it's possible the discovery may have pointed all the evidence towards your client in a way that wasn't imagined before the case began.
Well, what I would say about discovery is this. First of all, I agree with Mr. Creason that 56D was not complied with. Second, there's two places in the record where counsel for Mr. Christensen says Mr. Moser was complying with discovery. Okay? That we responded to discovery. I gave deposition dates for Mr. Moser's deposition. The motion to compel was not even involved Mr. Moser. It involved P1FCU and Christensen on these policies. It had nothing to do with Mr. Moser. And I think to say that Mr. Moser should be kept in this case because of a discovery dispute between P1FCU and Christensen, when it didn't involve him, he complied with discovery, especially with these 31 declarations of the record. And so my time is about up, and so the bottom line, Your Honors, is that Mr. Moser should not be an individual party in this proceeding at this point on the state of the record. The only cause of action directs against him was dismissed. And for those reasons, I join with P1FCU and request in this court affirm the decision of the district court in its entirety. Well, thank you for your time. I'm sorry I went so fast.
Thank you, sir. Your time. Madam Clerk, how much time remains for the account?
6 minutes, Your Honor.
Ms. Reeves?
Justice Zahn, you asked me to get you a record site for Mr. Christensen's trial testimony, his deposition testimony, identifying Mr. Moser, and that is at page 266, and it's the Christensen deposition transcript, page 255, lines 10 to 25. There is also another section that indicates what you were referring to when we were exchanging dialogue, and at that portion, he does just say people were accessing his account, and that's found at page 238 through 240. Of his deposition transcripts.
So I'm going to take you to the point brought up by Mr. Anabon about the morphing of the allegations into tortious interference with prospective economic advantage from a pleading of tortious interference with contract. Has that happened? Is that what's...
I don't think it happened, Your Honor. I put in my brief that the caption was wrong, but when you read the way that the claim was stated. But when you read the actual allegations, it was the future ability to contract and the future ability to earn money from these anticipated contracts. And on reconsideration, trial counsel did clarify that for the district court. I do take exception to the characterization that this case was about one fundamental question of fact, whether or not Mr. Moser disseminated the information. That is truly the core of the case to a jury. But on summary judgment, it is not the only issue to which trial counsel was trying to address and get discovery. He certainly was trying to address those disputed issues of fact that he felt were relevant. Mr. Anagon criticizes him because of the order of depositions he intended to take. Opposing counsel does not get to decide how you're going to put your case together. Their obligation is to comply with the discovery rules and cooperate in timely discovery. They do not get to say to you, as happened here, You don't need those depositions because I've got affidavits, so you are not getting those depositions. I deem those irrelevant. If you think something's irrelevant, your recourse is to the trial court. It's not to refuse to give deposition dates.
So, counsel, let me ask you, would you, the respondents argued that this issue of whether Mr. Moser disclosed the information outside of Potlatch was an essential element of, and I understood them to say, of all the claims pled in the case. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Justice Vaughn.
And so, on summary judgment, before that's argued, the court hears the motion to continue. What did your client request in the course of that argument with the court that would go to the issue of the disclosure outside of Potlatch?
So he was requesting items from which inferences could be drawn. So he was requesting their policies, their procedures, their protocols, which would have told him how to track within Potlatch Credit Union whether information was accessed and by whom and what policies they had on that, so that he would first of all know whether Mr. Moser had a reason to be accessing his accounts, although later his declaration says he doesn't remember why. He was also seeking those items that went to his, well, Justice is like eight notes. He was also seeking his discovery on Interrogatory 14 of violations of their policies, because he's looking to see if Mr. Moser had a tendency or had been reprimanded in the past for violating those policies. Discovery is like layering. You start off with fundamentals and then you build from that. And Mr. Anagon is exactly right. He was cooperating in getting Mr. Moser's deposition scheduled, but there's no purpose for counsel to take a deposition unless you're armed with the information you want to question the person about. When you have two defendants and one of them holds the information and won't provide it to you, and that's critical to taking depositions, you're signing.
And so, counsel, that was a very articulate answer to my question, and I appreciate it. Did trial counsel articulate any of that to the trial court when arguing the motion to continue? And it doesn't have to be the same way you articulated it, but any sort of summary or sense of that need.
I don't know that he did it in oral argument, but I believe his written submissions did articulate that, yes.
Okay.
His oral argument was not, as you can tell, I'm wordy and verbose. I don't think Mr. Turner is quite as wordy and verbose as I am. So his oral argument, I think, was more truncated, but his submissions were definitely filled with those type of reasonings to the court. I would like to leave the court with the holding. It is not binding on this court of Merrifield versus Arabi put out by our Court of Appeals, citing to the U.S. case of Salatex, that it's implicit in the concept of the summary judgment motion that adequate time for discovery has been afforded to the party defending the motion, and it is especially important when the relevant facts are exclusively in the control of the opposing party. A diligent party should be given a reasonable opportunity to prepare his case. Granting summary judgment will help to be an error when discovery is not complete, as, for example, when there's a motion before the court to compel a response to discovery effort. Thank you, Justices, for the opportunity to argue today in Portland, Idaho.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Counsel, thank you. As a matter of calendar advisement, we will render a decision. We wish to thank you from this distance. Normally, we have a tradition to come down and shake hands and speak to you directly. We're building that given the circumstances. But on behalf of the court, I commend each of you for fine work today and a little argument and in the briefing. We do appreciate that. The court will be in recess. Thank you.
All rise, please.